Okay, let's travel. Now it's time for us to pack up these concepts and hit the road. Through the rest of this book, I'll share specific examples of travel as a political act. In the former Yugoslavia, Croatia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, and Montenegro, we'll wander through the psychological and physical wreckage left in the aftermath of a tragic war, take note of the recovery, and ponder the sobering lessons. Considering the European Union, we'll see how a great society living in a parallel world to ours is evolving. The EU is melding together a vast free trade zone while trying to keep alive the cultural equivalent of the family farm, its ethnic diversity. And yet the EU is facing unprecedented challenges that threaten its continued survival. We'll consider the impact of Britain leaving the EU, Brexit, the rise of the populist far right on the continent, and the influx of war refugees. Traveling to El Salvador, we'll learn about the impact of globalization and the reality of a poor country being at the mercy of a rich country from its own perspective rather than ours. In Denmark, by delving into contemporary socialism and a hippie attempt at creating a utopia in a society routinely rated the most content in the world, we'll have a stimulating chance to consider a different formula for societal success. Visiting Turkey and Morocco, we'll witness the challenges and advances of the moderate side of Islam, along with the realities of a rising tide of authoritarianism and of Islamic fundamentalism. This helps balance our perspective at a time when the news of Islam is dominated by coverage of extremists and terrorists. In the Netherlands, Spain, Switzerland, Portugal, and the United States, we'll compare European and American drug policies, contrasting how equally affluent and advanced societies deal with the same persistent problem in fundamentally different ways. Exploring Iran, we'll see how fear and fundamentalism can lead a mighty nation to trade democracy for theocracy, and what happens when the excess of evil meets the great Satan, and we'll do it from an Iranian perspective. In Israel and Palestine, we'll illustrate how visiting a conflicted land helps you connect with people on both sides. You'll hear both narratives, not just the one that receives more media coverage within our society. Finally, I'll explain why flying home from each trip reminds me how thankful I am to live in America. Why I believe the rich blessings we enjoy as Americans come with certain stewardship responsibilities, and how we can enrich our lives by employing our new perspective more constructively back home. Before we travel to former Yugoslavia, here are four sidebars from Chapter 1. Family pride and fine wine. I'm inspired by how the pride of a family business or regional specialty stays strong generation after generation. In Italy's Umbria region, I have long taken my tour groups to the Bottai family vineyard. Cecilia, the oldest daughter, is no longer the little girl I once knew. Now, as her parents are taking it easy, she greets us at the gate and shares her family's passion with us. Cecilia walks us through the vineyard, introducing grape plants as if they were her children. As we follow her into the dark, cool tunnels of her vast cellar dug 1,000 years ago, she finds just the right bottle to share. And finally, we gather at the family dining table in a room that has changed little for 200 years. On my last visit, I remember enjoying Cecilia's pride and happiness as she popped open a bottle of their fine Orvieto Classico wine. Watching my glass fill, I noticed her hand gripped the bottle in a way that framed the family name on the label. And I noticed how her mother and now frail grandmother looked on silently and proudly as visitors from the other side of the world gathered in their home. On that remote farm in Italy, where the Bottai family had been producing wine for countless generations, my group was tasting the fruit of their land, labor, and culture. And our hosts were beaming with joy. When your name is on the label, you take great joy in sharing. A haunting photo from 1932 Munich, the normalization of Nazism. I have a photo that haunts me. It's 1932 in Munich at a political rally for Germany's resurgent National Socialist Party, Nazis for short. I imagine that the people filling this room are mostly good, decent citizens. But their thinking has become corrupted by anger, fear, and frustration. They're stinging from Germany's humiliating loss in World War I and the draconian Treaty of Versailles that's hampering the recovery of their nation. The Great Depression has left many without jobs and desperate, and their leaders are telling them that insidious others, Jews and communists, are responsible for their hardships. The world, they believe, is rigged against them. The Nazis are expert at capitalizing on the concerns of voters like these. For example, they promise an ambitious infrastructure program that will reinvigorate the once mighty economy, a vast network of super freeways lacing their country together. They have the backing of German industrialists who, terrified of the communist alternative, throw their support and their Reichsmarks behind the Nazis. The party's propagandists expertly turn hateful half-truths into tenets of the party. And, most important of all, they're led by a charismatic, dogmatic ruler called, literally, the leader, Der Führer. He's a master at repeating lies so convincingly that his followers eventually believe him. Much of the world dismisses him as a clown, a buffoon, an outrageous showman. But just enough Germans are swayed by his Deutschland über alles ideas. A year later, Adolf Hitler will be narrowly elected chancellor. Within weeks, the Reichstag, Germany's parliament building, will be mysteriously burned, giving the Führer the perfect opportunity to justify drastic law and order measures, unleashing the Nazis to purge their enemies from the government and reshape the German state. Within a few years, tens of millions will be dead, and Germany, and much of Europe, will be a smoldering ruin. All because of the dangerous ideas that caught on in rallies like the one shown in this photograph. Being a student of history brings meaning to your travels, and traveling to learn the stories of other countries can help us recognize potential threats in their infancy. Many observers have watched with alarm the rise of populist, nativist, rabble-rousing movements on both sides of the Atlantic. These movements may not be fascist, but there's no question they're using the fascist playbook. Students of history have a better understanding of how these movements can rise. They know how dangerously things can escalate if the safeguards of a healthy democracy, a free and respected press, an independent judiciary, and engaged voters are trumped by anger and fear. Terrorism by the numbers. I believe that when we overreact to the threat of terrorism, we empower the terrorists and actually become part of the problem. By setting emotion aside and being as rational as possible, we can weigh the relative risks and rewards or costs and benefits of various American behaviors. While I realize it may seem heartless to reduce tragic deaths to mere numbers, let's try a thought experiment and be purely left-brained for a moment. Every week, a 747's worth of people die on our American highways. And it's not worth headlines. We're a mighty nation of well over 300 million people. People die. More than 30,000 people die on our roads every year. Any expert would tell you that if we all drove 20 miles an hour slower, we'd save thousands of precious lives. But in the privacy of the voting booth, is the average American going to vote to drive 50 miles an hour on our freeways to save thousands of lives? Hell no. We've got places to go. Consider guns. Every year in our country, more than 10,000 people are killed by guns. 30,000 if you include suicides. You could make the case that that's a reasonable price to pay for the precious right to bear arms. We are a free and well-educated democracy. We know the score, and year after year, as a society, we seem to agree that spending these lives is a reasonable trade-off for enjoying our Second Amendment right. Germans decided not to have that right to bear arms, and consequently, they lose around 100 people a year to guns. Europeans, who suffer less than a quarter the per capita gun killings we do, laugh out loud when they hear that Americans are staying home for safety reasons. If you care about your loved ones and understand the statistics, you'll take them to Europe tomorrow. If we dispassionately surveyed the situation, we might similarly accept the human cost of our aggressive stance on this planet. We spend tens of thousands of lives a year for the right to drive fast and to bear arms. Perhaps more than 300 million Americans being seen by the rest of the world as an empire is another stance that comes with an unavoidable cost in human lives. The U.S. spends more than $600 billion annually on its military. That's triple the second-place spender, China, and far more than the European Union. I know this is wild, but imagine we changed our priorities and de-emphasized our military might in favor of soft power. Fantasize for a moment about the money and energy we could save, and all the good we could do with those resources if even just a fraction was compassionately and wisely diverted to challenges like climate change or the plight of desperate people in lands that have no oil or strategic importance, whose suffering barely registers in the media. Imagine then the resulting goodwill and what that would do to the American image abroad. We'd be tougher for our terrorist enemies to demonize. And imagine the challenge that would present to terrorist recruiters. Walter Cronkite and Entertainment Masquerading as News. Why are Americans so fearful of the world these days? Fearful enough, in some cases, that they're bullied into staying home. I think it has to do with the way our news industry has changed. Back when Walter Cronkite brought America the news, he closed each broadcast with his famous tagline, "And that's the way it is." Back then, I believe that, to the best of the network's ability, that really was the way it was. In those days, commercial networks saw the news hour as a public service and a civic responsibility. Reporting the news in a truthful and impartial way was their contribution to our society as corporate citizens. In fact, until 1987, it was actually the law, the FCC's fairness doctrine. Essentially, Congress granted the broadcast networks the right to use American airwaves with just one string attached. They had to keep the populace informed. This quid pro quo was respected for decades, even though properly researched and reported news doesn't come cheap. When they wrote Walter Cronkite his paycheck, they did it without regard to profit. Traditionally, network news wasn't about making money. It was about making American society smarter and therefore stronger. Unfortunately, those days are long gone. With the end of the fairness doctrine and the rise of 24-hour news, media are focused on reaching as many eyeballs as possible so they can charge advertisers enough to pay for their good-looking anchors, no offense, Walter, and still have plenty of profit left over. If not enough people are watching, they're desperate to boost viewership. So they sex it up, bloody it up, crisis it up until enough people watch. The result? Commercial TV news has become entertainment masquerading as news. As the news becomes more sensationalized, the viewer becomes more fearful. And eventually all that fear metastasizes into the political realm. In the long run, the transformation of news from information to entertainment, making us feel that we're less safe, threatens the fabric of our democracy and, ironically, actually makes our country less safe. Of course, many conscientious, hardworking journalists still produce news that's designed to inform rather than entertain. But these days, they are shouting into a chaotic, overloaded media landscape. One sad byproduct of the sensationalization of news is that it's eroded respect for all journalism, even the good kind. When you train the public to view news as entertainment, it's an easy transition to sell them trumped-up scandal and salacious rumor as news. The decline of real news has coincided with the rise of fake news, intentionally bogus but titillating stories, like President Obama was born in Kenya. These stories then spread like wildfire in social media. People can choose their news, and news itself is becoming subjective, rather than the way it is. By dumbing down our news, we've sacrificed the credibility of journalism and the great legacy of Walter Cronkite. And in a society where journalism has always served as an unofficial fourth estate, to keep watch over the executive, legislative, and judicial branches, this is a tragic and troubling development indeed. Chapter 2. Lessons from the Former Yugoslavia, War and Peace in Modern Times. Since World War II, Europe has enjoyed unprecedented peace, except in its southeastern Balkan Peninsula. As Yugoslavia broke apart violently in the early 1990s, the rest of the world watched in disbelief and then in horror as former compatriots tore apart their homeland and each other. Today, just a generation later, some parts of the former Yugoslavia have already reemerged as major tourist attractions. In recent years, I've enjoyed trips to countries that once belonged to Yugoslavia, including Croatia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, and Montenegro. As destinations, they offer profound natural beauty, a relaxing ambiance, and a warm welcome. Life goes on here. Local people, while not in denial about the war, would rather not be constantly reminded of it. Many think about this ugliness in their past only when tourists ask them about it. And yet, although I realize that in some ways it does a disservice to these places to view them through a lens of war, I can't help but think about those not-too-distant horrors as I travel there. Seeing the bruised remnants of Yugoslavia is painful yet wonderfully thought-provoking. And because this book is about how travel can change the way you think about the world, I hope you and my Balkan friends will excuse my narrow focus on that war in this chapter. We begin at the region's top tourist hotspot, the town of Dubrovnik in Croatia. Nowhere else in Europe can you go so quickly from easy tourism to lands where today's struggles are so vivid and eye-opening, one of many heartbreaking sectarian conflicts all around the globe. Within a few hours' drive of Dubrovnik are several new incarnations of old nations, providing rich opportunities to study the roots and the consequences of one such struggle. Red roofs and mortar shells in Dubrovnik. I was ready for a little culture shock. Flying from France to Dubrovnik, I got it. I passed through the mammoth floodlit walls of Dubrovnik's old town and hiked up a steep, tourist-free back lane to my boutique pension perched at the top of Europe's finest fortified port city. Upon reaching my favorite Dubrovnik B&B, I was greeted by Pero Tsarevich. We bellied up to the counter in his kitchen, and Pero uncorked a bottle of the local fire water. Hoping to write that evening with a clear head, I tried to refuse Pero's drink. But this is a Slavic land. Remembering times when I was force-fed vodka in Russia by new friends, I knew it was hopeless. Pero had made this hooch himself with green walnuts. As he slugged down a shot, he handed me a glass, wheezing, "Walnut grappa. It recovers your energy." As we drank, Pero told me his story. This gorgeous stone and knotty wood house where he grew up suffered a direct hit during the 8-month siege of Dubrovnik in 1991. After the war, Pero got a monthly retirement check for being wounded, but was bored and didn't want to live on the tiny government stipend. So he went to work and turned the remains of his old town home into a fine guest house. With a twinkle in his eye, Pero reached under the counter and held up the mangled tail of a mortar shell, the very shell that destroyed his childhood home. He put the mortar in my hands. Just as I don't enjoy holding a gun, I didn't enjoy touching the twisted remains of that mortar. I took Pero's photograph. He held the mortar and smiled. I didn't want him to hold the mortar and smile, but that's what he did. He seemed determined to smile, as if it signified a personal victory over the destruction the mortar had wrought. It's impressive how people can weather tragedy, rebuild, and move on. Despite the terrors of war just a couple of decades ago, life here was once again very good and, according to Pero's smile, filled with promise. From Pero's perch high above Dubrovnik's rooftops, I studied the view. Countless buildings lassoed within the stout medieval walls. The city is a patchwork of old-fashioned red-tile roofs. Perro explained that the random arrangement of bright and dark-toned roof tiles indicates the damage caused by the mortars that were lobbed over the hill by the Serb-dominated Yugoslav National Army in 1991. The new, brighter-colored tiles marked houses that were hit and had to be rebuilt. At a glance, it's clear that more than two-thirds of the old town's buildings were bombed. But today, relations between the Croats and their Serb neighbors are on the mend. Perro, whose B&B now houses the very Serbs who may have bombed his home years ago, says that, with age, someday all the tiles will fade to exactly the same hue. Poignant as a visit to Dubrovnik may be, rich rewards await those who push on into the interior of the former Yugoslavia. Dubrovnik, the most touristy and comfortable resort on Croatia's Dalmatian coast, is an ideal springboard for more scintillating sightseeing, including some sobering lessons in sectarian strife. But first, it's important to understand the recent history of the region. Balkans 101. We hear the term the Balkans now and then, and even if we don't know exactly where that is, we know it's a challenging place. The Balkan Peninsula, a wide swath of land in southeastern Europe, stretching from Hungary to Greece, has long been a crossroads of cultures. Over the centuries, an endless string of emperors, crusaders, bishops, and sultans have shaped a region that's extremely diverse and unusually troubled. These troubles are most profound in the former Yugoslavia, roughly the western half of this peninsula. Yugoslavia's delicate ethnic balance is notoriously difficult to grasp. The major ethnicities of Yugoslavia were all South Slavs. They're descended from the same ancestors and speak closely related languages. In fact, the word Yugoslavia means roughly the union of the South Slavic peoples. The distinguishing difference is that they practice different religions. Catholic South Slavs are called Croats. Orthodox South Slavs are called Serbs. And Muslim South Slavs, whose ancestors converted to Islam under Ottoman rule, are called Bosniaks. For the most part, there's no way that a casual visitor can determine the ethnicity of the people just by looking at them. While relatively few people are actively religious here, because of the stifling atheism of the communist years, they fiercely identify with their ethnicity. And because ethnicity and faith are synonymous, it's easy to mistake the recent conflicts for religious wars. But in reality, they were about the politics of ethnicity. Just as the Troubles in Ireland were more about British versus Irish rule than simply a holy war between Catholics and Protestants. Yugoslavia was an artificial union of the various South Slav ethnicities that lasted from the end of World War I until 1991. Following the death of its strong-arm leader, Tito, Yugoslavia was plunged into war by a spate of land-hungry politicians, a storm of ethnic divisions, and a heritage of fear and mistrust. Many consider the conflict a civil war, and others see it as a series of wars of independence. However you define the wars, they and the ethnic cleansing, systematic rape, and other atrocities that accompanied them were simply horrific. It's almost miraculous that after a few very bloody years, from 1991 to 1995, the many factions laid down their arms and agreed to peace accords. An uneasy peace, firmer and more inspiring with each passing year, has settled over the region. And yet, hard feelings linger. As a travel writer, I've learned again and again that discussing this region is fraught with controversy. Every time I publish an article on the former Yugoslavia, I receive angry complaints that say I'm taking sides. Strangely, I typically hear this complaint from each side in equal numbers, which suggests I'm actually succeeding at being impartial. I believe that if you lined up a panel of experts from the region, historians from prestigious universities, respected journalists, beloved diplomats, and asked them for their take on a particular issue or historical event, each one would have a different version of the events, presented as fact. One person's war hero is another person's war criminal. One person's freedom fighter is another person's terrorist. One person's George Washington is another person's Adolf Hitler. It's aggravating, and yet so human. As an outside observer, the best I can do is to sort through the opinions, force myself to see all sides of the story, collect a few random observations to share as food for thought, and encourage readers to learn from the region's tumult. But there's no substitute for traveling here in person. Walking with the victims of war through the ruins of their cities gives you war coverage you'd never get in front of a TV. Seeing how former enemies find new ways to overcome their animosity and heal, enjoying the new energy that teenagers whose parents did the fighting bring to the streets, and observing combatants who followed no rules, now raising children in the ruins resulting from their mistakes, all of it leaves a strong impression on any visitor. Buffalo Nickel Charm on a Road That Does Not Exist. Looking for a change of pace from Croatia's Dalmatian coast, I drove from Dubrovnik to the city of Mostar in Bosnia-Herzegovina. Almost everyone doing this trip takes the scenic coastal route, but I took the back road instead. Inland first, then looping north through the Serb part of Bosnia-Herzegovina. While Bosnia-Herzegovina is one country, the 1995 peace accords gerrymandered the land to grant a degree of autonomy to the area where Orthodox Serbs predominate. This Serbian republic, while technically part of Bosnia-Herzegovina, rings the Muslim and Croat-dominated core of the country on three sides. When asked for driving tips, Croatians, who avoid the Serbian republic, insisted that the road I hoped to take didn't even exist. As I drove inland from Dubrovnik, directional signs sent me to the tiny Croatian border town, but ignored the major Serb city of Trebinje just beyond. But despite warnings from Croats in Dubrovnik, I found plenty past that lonely border. As I entered bustling Trebinje, police with ping-pong paddle stop signs pulled me over to inform me that drivers need to have their headlights on at all hours. The dumb tourist routine got me off the hook. At an ATM, I withdrew Bosnia-Herzegovina's currency, called the convertible mark. The name goes back to the 1980s, when, like other countries with fractured economies, they tied their currency to a strong one. It was named after the German mark and given the same value. Today, while Germany has long since switched over to the euro, the original German mark lives on, with its original exchange rate, in a quirky way, in Bosnia. But, like the country itself, convertible marks are divided. To satisfy the country's various factions, the currency uses both the Roman and the Cyrillic alphabets. The bills have different figureheads and symbols. Some bills feature Bosniaks, others Serbs. I stowed a few Bosnian coins as souvenirs. They have the charm of Indian pennies and buffalo nickels. Coming upon a vibrant market, I had to explore. The produce seemed entirely local. Honey maids eagerly offered me tastes, as if each believed her honey was the sweetest. Small-time farmers, salt-of-the-earth couples as rustic as the dirty potatoes they pulled out of the ground that morning, lovingly displayed their produce on rickety card tables. A tourist here was so rare that there was nothing designed for me to buy. Coming from Croatia, I was primed to think of Serbs as villains. Wandering through the market, I saw only a hard-working community of farmers offering a foreigner a warm, if curious, welcome. High on a hill overlooking Trebinje is a stately Serbian Orthodox church with an opulence that belies the modesty of the town filling the valley below. And, as with everything here, its symbolism is loaded. It's modeled after a historically important monastery in Kosovo, now an independent country that Serbs still claim as their own. Exploring the grounds, I bumped into a youthful monk who had been an exchange student in Cleveland. He had a great sense of humor about our cultural differences. I explained that part of my mission was to help Americans understand rather than fear people who looked different. Stroking his long black beard, which matched his long black robe, he joked with a knowing wink, "Around here, a priest without a beard looks suspicious." As I continued along the road, it became apparent that the complex nature of things here comes across in the powerful language of flags. Just as bars throughout Europe don't want football team colors, and pubs throughout Ireland don't want the green or orange of the sectarian groups, flags in this region come with lots of pent-up political anger. Throughout the day, I saw different flags, each one flying with an agenda. Croats salute their red and white checkerboard flag, while Serbs proudly hoist their flag with four C's, the first letter of Serb in the Cyrillic alphabet. But in the not-too-distant past, each of these flags was also employed by an oppressive regime, so Croats and Serbs each view the other's flag as the equivalent to a swastika. Meanwhile, the country's official flag, which nobody really embraces or is offended by, is a yellow and blue triangle and stars configuration dreamed up by the European Union. While most tourists can't tell the difference, locals notice subtle clues that indicate they're entering a different ethnicity's home turf. These include those highly symbolic flags, discreet but hateful graffiti symbols, pictures of old Serbian kings stenciled onto abandoned buildings, ruined castles guarding ghosts of centuries-old threats on strategic mountain passes, new road signs with politically charged names, and even ATMs with instructions in just one language, Croatian, Bosnian, or Serbian, but not all three. During the days of Yugoslavia, these languages were all lumped together into a single, mutually intelligible mother tongue called Serbo-Croatian. But, stoked by the patriotism of proud new nationhood, each of these groups artificially distanced its language from the others, inventing new words to replace ones they found too Serbian or too Croatian. While I met generally gentle and thoughtful people in all communities here, I can also see the potential for more of the sectarian tumult that made the 1990s so terrible. There's a certain strata of society in each ethnic community, and when you see them, you can't help but think, for war, just add bullets and agitate. A cafe filled with skinhead bodybuilders made me think brains and brawn are a zero-sum game. Some were built like big tubes with muscles that seemed to squeeze their heads really small. They lived in poverty amidst broken concrete and angry graffiti with little but unemployment in their futures. Later, after a 2-hour drive on deserted roads through a rugged landscape, I arrived at the humble Serb crossroads village of Nevesinja. Towns in this region all have a cafe row, and Nevesinja is no exception. It was lunchtime, but as I walked through the town, I didn't see a soul with any food on the table, just drinks. In this village, where unemployment is epidemic, it seems locals eat cheaply at home and then enjoy an affordable coffee or drink at a cafe. A cluttered little grocery, with a woman behind the counter happy to make a sandwich, was my answer for lunch. The salami looked like spam. Going through the sanitary motions, she laid down a piece of waxed paper to catch the meat. But the slices landed wetly on the grotty base of the slicer as they were cut. A strong cup of Bosnian coffee, we'd call it Turkish coffee, with loose ground settled in the bottom, just cost pennies in the adjacent cafe. Munching my sandwich and sipping the coffee carefully to avoid the mud, I watched the street scene. Big men drove by in little beaters. High school students crowded around the window of the local photography shop, which had just posted their class graduation photos. The schoolgirls on this cruising drag proved you don't need money to have style. Through a shop window, I could see a newly engaged couple picking out a ring. One moment, I saw Nevesinja as very different from my hometown, and the next, it seemed essentially the same. And then, as my eyes wandered to the curiously overgrown ruined building across the street, I noticed bricked-up pointed Islamic arches and realized it was once a mosque. As if surveying a horrible crime scene, I had to walk through its backyard. It was a no-man's land of broken concrete and glass. A single, half-knocked-over, turban-shaped tombstone still managed to stand. The prayer niche inside, where no one prays anymore, now faced a vacant lot. The idea that there was a bloody war in this country in your own lifetime is abstract until you actually come here. Walking these streets, I talked with locals about the cruel quirkiness of this war. The towns that got off relatively easy were the ones with huge majorities of one or the other faction. The tiny minority group would simply be run out of town. Towns with the most bloodshed and destruction were the most diverse, where no single ethnic group dominated. Because Nevesinje was a predominantly Orthodox town, the Serbs killed or forced out the Muslims and destroyed their mosque. Surviving Muslim refugees reportedly had to walk for a week over a mountain pass to safety in the Muslim-dominated city of Mostar, where, Serbs like to say, they found better living conditions anyway. Remaining impartial is an ongoing challenge. It's so tempting to think of the Muslims who were brutalized in many parts of Bosnia-Herzegovina as the victims. But when traveling here, I have to keep reminding myself that elsewhere in this conflict, Serbs or Croats were victimized in much the same way. Early in the war, outcast Serbs migrated to safety in the opposite direction, from Mostar to Nevesinje. On the hillside overlooking Mostar are the ruins of a once magnificent Serbian Orthodox church, now demolished, just like that mosque in Nevesinje. Travel allows you to fill out a balanced view of a troubled region, especially if you visit an area that your home media portrays as the enemy. Considering the haphazardness of war, I remembered how in France's charming Alsace, the region bordering Germany, all towns go back centuries. Some were perfectly preserved, while those with the misfortune to be caught in the steamroller of war don't have a building standing from before 1945. I recalled that in England, the town of Chester survived, while the Nazis leveled nearby Coventry so thoroughly that it brought a new word into their language for bombing to smithereens, to Coventrate a place. And I remembered the confused patchwork of Dubrovnik's old and new tile roofs. These images, and now this sad ruined mosque, all humanized the bleak reality and random heartbreak of sectarian strife and war. Ready to move on, I climbed into my little car, left Nevesinje, and drove out of the mountains. My destination was a city that once symbolized East and West coming together peacefully, then symbolized just the opposite, and today seems to be enjoying a tentative new spirit of peaceful coexistence. Mostar. Bosnian Hormones and a Shiny New Cemetery. Exploring the city of Mostar with its vibrant humanity and the persistent reminders of its recent and terrible war was both exhilarating and emotionally exhausting. Mostar represents the best and the worst of Yugoslavia. During the Tito years, it was an idyllic mingling of cultures, Catholic Croats, Orthodox Serbs, and Muslim Bosniaks living together in relative harmony, their differences spanned by an old bridge that symbolized an optimistic vision of a Yugoslavia where ethnicity didn't matter. And yet, as the country unraveled in the early 1990s, Mostar was gripped by a gory three-way war among those same groups. Not that long ago, the people I now encountered here, those who brought me a coffee at a cafe, stopped for me when I jaywalked, showed off their paintings, and directed the church choir, had been killing each other. Mostar's 400-year-old Turkish-style stone bridge, with its elegant, single-pointed arch, was symbolic of the town's status as the place where East met West in Europe. Then, during the 1990s, Mostar became the tragic poster child of the Bosnian War. Across the world, people felt the town's pain when its beloved bridge, bombarded from the hilltop above, finally collapsed into the river. Now the bridge has been rebuilt, and Mostar is putting itself back together. But some scars of the war are still evident. Most of the Serbs who once lived here have fled deeper into the countryside, into the Serbian Republic. The two groups who still live here are effectively segregated along the front line that divided them during wartime, the Muslims on the east side and the Croats on the west. While the two groups are making some efforts at reintegration, progress has been slow. In 2005, some young Mostarians unveiled a statue. Rather than celebrating a political or military hero, it was of Bruce Lee, who they saw as symbolizing the fight for positive values that all sides could identify with. Lee, who struggled with ethnic divisions between Chinese and white Americans, represented to the people of Mostar an inspirational bridging of cultures. Sadly, 2 days after the unveiling, even that statue was vandalized. But there has been lots of progress. As I explored the workaday streets of the town, it seemed that, despite the war damage, Mostar was downright thriving. Turk Musala, literally Place for Prayer Square, is designed for big gatherings. Muslim groups meet at the square before departing for Mecca on their pilgrimage, or Hajj. But on the night of my visit, there was not a hint of prayer. It was prom night. The kids were out. Bosnian hormones were raging. Being young and sexy is a great equalizer. With a beer, loud music, desirability, twinkling stars, and no war, your family's income and your country's GDP hardly matter. Today's 18-year-old Mostarians have no personal memory of the war that shaped their parents' lives. Looking at these kids and their dried-apple grandparents clad in dusty black warming benches on the Place for Prayer Square, I imagine that there must be quite a generation gap. I was swirling in a snow globe of teenagers, and through the commotion, a 30-something local came at me with a huge smile. Alan from Orlando. Actually, he's from Mostar, but fled to Florida during the war, and now spends summers with his family here. A fan of my public television series, he immediately offered to show me around his hometown. Alan's local perspective gave Mostar meaning. He pointed to a fig tree growing out of the window of a small minaret. Seeming to speak as much about Mostar's people as its vegetation, Alan said, "It's a strange thing in nature. Figs can grow with almost no soil." Even along the main drag, there were still blackened ruins from the war. When I asked why, after more than 2 decades, that prime property still had not been touched, Alan explained, "There's confusion about who owns what. Surviving companies have no money. The Bank of Yugoslavia, which held the mortgages, is now gone. No one will invest until it's clear who owns the buildings." I had never considered the financial confusion that follows the breakup of a country and how it could stunt a society's redevelopment. We walked to a small cemetery congested with more than 100 white marble Muslim tombstones. Alan pointed out the dates. Everyone died in 1993, 94, or 95. Before 1993, this was a park. When the war heated up, snipers were a constant concern. They'd pick off anyone they saw walking down the street. Because of the ongoing danger, bodies were left for weeks rotting on the main boulevard, which had become the front line. Mostar's cemeteries were too exposed to be used, but this tree-filled park was relatively safe from snipers. People buried their neighbors here, under the cover of darkness. Weaving slowly through the tombstones, Alan explained, "In those years, night was the time when we lived. We didn't walk, we ran. And we dressed in black. There was no electricity. If the Croats didn't kill us with their bullets, they killed us with their music." That politically charged, rabble-rousing Croatian pop music, used apparently effectively as a kind of psychological torture, was blasting constantly from the Croat side of town. As we wandered through town, the sectarian symbolism of the conflict was powerful. 10 minarets pierced Mostar's skyline like proud Muslim exclamation points. Across the river, twice as high as the tallest minaret, stood the Croat's new Catholic church spire. Standing on the reconstructed old bridge, I looked at the hilltop high above the town with its single, bold, and strongly floodlit cross. Alan said, "We believe that cross marks the spot from where they shelled this bridge. They built it there intentionally and floodlighted each night like a celebration." You can travel all the way to a place as instructive and fascinating as Mostar and not quite cross the goal line. It's important to reach beyond the tourist-friendly zones and connect with real neighborhoods. That evening, leaving my hotel with dinner in mind, I reflexively headed for the romantic strip of touristy restaurants with English menus and glorious views of the iconic and floodlit bridge. But then, my appetite for education commanded, halt. Rather than the easy, no-stress dinner on the riverfront, I stopped, turned 180 degrees, walked in the opposite direction, and risked earning a lifelong memory. I took my business to the main boulevard, the former front line where a few tentative businesses had reopened. I stumbled upon a new-looking cafe and ordered a plate of stuffed peppers and a Sarajevo beer. The young man who served me had just opened his bar here, on the Muslim side. Immediately across the street stands the new Catholic church with its oversized steeple. He said that while bullets are no longer flying, he was worried about vandalism from young, hate-filled men across the road. He had been open 2 months, and so far, no problem. Eating my meal, I was surrounded by poignant sights and sounds. First, a warbly call to prayer echoed across town. Then the church bells tolled with determination across the street. All the while, a little boy with training wheels on his pint-sized bike pedaled vigorously around and around the new sidewalk by a bomb-damaged line of buildings and grass too young to walk on. He went faster and faster, gaining confidence with each circle. The next day, I popped into a small theater where 30 Slovenes from the northernmost part of former Yugoslavia, which avoided the terrible destruction of the war, were watching a short film about the old bridge, its destruction, and its rebuilding. The persistent shelling of the venerable bridge, so rich in symbolism, seemed to go on and on. The Slovenes knew the story well, but when the video reached the moment when the bridge finally fell, I heard a sad collective gasp. It reminded me of how Americans feel, even well after 9/11, when watching video of the World Trade Center disappearing into a column of ash. This experience helped me, if not feel, at least appreciate another country's pain. At lunchtime, I stopped at a tiny grocery store, where I was happy to see a woman I had befriended the day before. She was a gorgeous person, sad to be living in a frustrating economy, and stiff with a piece of shrapnel in her back that doctors decided was safer left in. She made me a hearty ham sandwich and helped me gather the ingredients for what would be a fine picnic. Stooping to pick up items on the shelves lower than she could bend to reach, I considered how this woman's life will be forever marred by that war. The sentiment I hear from locals when I visit this region is, I don't know how we could have been so stupid to wage that unnecessary war. I've never met anyone here who called the war anything but a tragic mistake. The lesson I learned from their mistake is the importance of taking pluralism within your society seriously. While Bosnian sectarianism may be particularly extreme, every society has groups that could come to blows, and failing to find a way to live peacefully together, as the people of Mostar learned, means everybody loses. That night in Mostar, as the teenagers ripped it up at their dance halls, I lay in bed, sorting out my impressions. Until the wee hours, a birthday party raged in the restaurant just outside my window. For hours, they sang songs. At first, I was annoyed. Then, I realized that a Bosniak Beach Boys party beats a night of shelling. In 2 hours of sing-alongs, everyone seemed to know all the words, and I didn't recognize a single tune. In spite of all its challenges and setbacks, I have no doubt that this Bosnian culture will rage on. Nouveau Riche and Humble Devotion on the Bay of Kotor. Circling back to Dubrovnik, I drove south to yet another new nation that emerged from the ashes of Yugoslavia, Montenegro. During my travels through this region, my punch-drunk passport would be stamped and stamped and stamped again. While the unification of Europe has made most border crossings feel archaic, the breakup of Yugoslavia has kept them in vogue here. Every time the country splintered, another border was set up. The poorer the country, it seems, the more ornate the border formalities. And by European standards, Montenegro is about as poor as it gets. They don't even have their own currency. With just 600,000 people, they decided, heck, let's just use euros. For me, Montenegro, whose name means Black Mountain, has always evoked the fratricidal chaos of a bygone age. I think of a time when fathers in the Balkans taught their sons that your neighbor's neighbor is your friend. in anticipation of future sectarian struggles. Back when, for generation after generation, so-and-so-ovich was pounding on so-and-so-ovich, a mountain stronghold was worth the misery. My recent visit showed me that this image is now dated. The country is on an upward trajectory, and many expect to see Montenegro emerging as a sunny new hotspot on the Adriatic coastline. International investors, mostly from Russia and Saudi Arabia, are pouring money into what they hope will become their very own Riviera. Unfortunately, when rich people paste a glitzy facade under the crumbling infrastructure of a poor country that isn't ready for it, you get a lot of pizzazz with no substance. I stayed at a supposedly designer hotel that, at first glance, felt so elite and exclusive that I expected to see Idi Amin poolside. But the hotel, opened just a month, was a comedy of horrible design. I felt like I was their first guest ever. My bathroom was far bigger than many European hotel rooms, but the toilet was jammed into the corner. I had to tuck up my knees to sit on it. The room was dominated by a big jacuzzi tub for two, but I'm certain there wasn't enough hot water available to fill it. I doubt it'll ever be used, except for something to look at as you're crunched up on the toilet. A huge thunderstorm hit our hotel with enough fury to keep the automatic glass doors opening and closing on their own. Nothing drained. A torrent ran down the stairs outside the front door. With the rain, a backed-up sewage smell drove me out of my room. And just as I sat down for a cup of coffee in the lounge, the lights went out. Peering past the candelabra on my table, the overwhelmed receptionist explained with a shrug, "When it rains, there is no electricity." The man who runs the place just looked at me and said, "Cows." I think he meant chaos. Eventually, the rain stopped, the clouds parted, and I continued exploring. The first major stop in Montenegro when arriving from Dubrovnik is the Bay of Kotor, where the Adriatic cuts into the steep mountains like a Norwegian fjord. And there, at the humble waterfront town of Perast, young guys in swimsuits edged their boats near the dock, jockeying to motor tourists out to the island in the middle of the bay. According to legend, fishermen saw the Virgin Mary in the reef and began a ritual of dropping a stone on the spot every time they sailed by. Eventually, the island we see today was created, and upon that island, the people built a fine little church. I hired a guy with a dinghy to ferry me out and was met by a young woman who gave me a tour. In the sacristy hung a piece of embroidery, a 25-year-long labor of love made by a local parishioner 200 years ago. It was as exquisite as possible, lovingly made with the finest materials available, silk, and the woman's own hair. I could trace her laborious progress through the line of cherubs that ornamented the border. As the years went by, the hair of the angels, like the hair of the devout artist, turned from dark brown to white. Humble and anonymous as she was, she had faith that her work was worthwhile and would be appreciated, as it is, 2 centuries later, by a steady parade of travelers from distant lands. I've been at my work for more than 3 decades now. I also have a faith that it, my work, if not my hair, will be appreciated after I'm gone. That's perhaps less humble than the woman was, but her work reassured me that we can live on through our deeds. Her devotion to her creation, as well as to her creator, is an inspiration to do both good and lasting work. While traveling, I'm often struck by how people give meaning to their life by producing and contributing. I didn't take a photograph of the embroidery that day. For some reason, I didn't even take notes. At the moment, I didn't realize I was experiencing the highlight of my day. The impression of the woman's tenderly created embroidery needed, like a good red wine, time to breathe. That was a lesson for me. I was already mentally on to the next thing. When the power of that impression opened up, it was rich and full-bodied, but I was long gone. If travel is going to have the impact on you that it should, you have to climb into those little dinghies and reach for those experiences. The best ones won't come to you, and you have to let them breathe. Monks, tracksuits, and Europe's worst piano in the heartland of Montenegro. Most tourists stick to Montenegro's scenic Bay of Kotor, but inspired by my backroads Bosnian experience, I was eager to get off the beaten path and head deep into the rugged interior of the Black Mountain. I climbed 25 switchbacks, someone painted numbers on each one, ascending from the Montenegrin coast with its breezy palm trees, bustling ice cream stands, and romantic harbor promenades, into a world of lonely goats, scrub brush, and remote, seemingly deserted farmhouses. At switchback number 4, I passed a ramshackle gypsy or Roma encampment. I thought about how all over our world nomadic cultures are struggling. They're at odds with societies that demand fences, conventional land ownership, and other non-nomadic ways. I wonder how many nomadic cultures, American Indians, Eskimos, Kurds, Bedouins, Roma, will still be here in generations to come. At switchback number 18, I pulled out for a grand view of the Bay of Kotor and, pulling on my sweater, marveled at how the vegetation, climate, and ambiance were completely different, just a few twists in the road above sea level. At switchback number 24, I noticed the old road faintly cutting up the adjacent slope. While little more than an overgrown donkey path, that was once the mountain kingdom's umbilical cord to the Adriatic, its connection to the world. The most vivid thing I remember about my last visit, decades ago, was that a grand piano had literally been carried up the mountain on that tiny lane so some big-shot nobleman could let it slowly go out of tune in his palace. As I crested the ridge, the sea disappeared, and before me stretched a basin defined by a ring of black mountains, Montenegro's heartland. Exploring the poorest corner of any European country can be eye-opening, but Montenegro's is more evocative than most. Desolate farmhouses posted handwritten signs advertising smoked ham, mountain cheese, and honey brandy. But I didn't see a soul. I came into a village that looked like it had no commerce at all. Stopping at a lonely tavern, I asked the bartender, "What do people do here?" He led me to a big, blocky, white building resembling a giant monopoly house. He opened the door, and I stepped inside, under tons of golden ham, aging peacefully. It was a smokehouse, jammed with 5 layers of hanging ham hocks. My new Montenegrin friend stoked up his fire, filling the place with smoke. Ever since, as I explore back lanes in sleepy villages, I'm mindful that more industry than I realize may be hiding out. The drive felt somehow menacing. Because up here the Cyrillic alphabet survives better than on the coast, most signage was illegible to me. But every 100 yards or so, the local towing company had spray-painted on a rock, in lettering seemingly designed for the stray tourist, Autoslep, 067-838-555. I had a feeling they were in the bushes, praying for a mishap. Pulling off for a photo of the valley, I noticed a plaque marking where Tito's trade minister was assassinated in a 1948 ambush. At the end of the road was Cetinje, which the road sign proclaimed as the old royal capital. I'm nostalgic about this town, a classic mountain kingdom, with that grotesquely out-of-tune grand piano, established as the capital in the 15th century. Cetinje was taken by the Ottomans several times. The rampaging Ottomans would generally move in and enjoy a little raping, pillaging, and plundering, but quickly realizing there was little hedonism to enjoy in Cetinje, they basically just destroyed the place and moved out. With the way clear, the rugged and determined residents filtered back into the ruins of their town, rebuilt, and awaited the next invasion. Today, Cetinje is a workaday, 2-story town with barely a hint of its old royal status. The museums are generally closed. The economy is flat. A shoe factory and a refrigerator factory were abandoned with Yugoslavia's breakup. They were part of Tito's economic vision for Yugoslavia, where, in the name of efficiency, individual products were made in huge quantities by government-run plants to supply the entire country. Kids on bikes rolled like tumbleweeds down the main street past old-timers with hard memories. At the edge of town is the St. Peter of Cetinje Orthodox Monastery, the still-beating spiritual heart of Montenegro. I stepped in. An Orthodox monk, black robe and beard flowing halfway to his waist, nodded a welcome. A service was in progress. Flames flickered on gilded icons. Incense created an otherworldly ambiance, and the chanting was almost hypnotic. I stood, as everyone does in Orthodox worship, in the back. People